This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Michael Deutsch from Chicago. He's handling the case of a Chicago man of Palestinian extraction being prosecuted for conspiracy to aid Hamas.
They've got a Palestinian businessman who was tortured by the Israelis, imprisoned in Israel for 5 years, shipped back to Chicago, and now they're going after him in Chicago using this statement that was extracted by torture to prosecute him in the United States.
Joining us will be Joan Mellon, author of the book on Jim Garrison and the JFK assassination.
This is a bombshell. Joan Mellon interviewed over 1,200 people in the course of 8 years of researching this book. She has newly released documents that filmmaker Oliver Stone got from the JFK assassination archives. She's cracked the case.
Joining us will be Joey Steele, New York City Youth Coordinator from The World Can't Wait, who conducts demonstrations against torture.
Joey's sitting here wearing an orange jumpsuit with a chain around his neck, and in fact has torture marks on his body from 2 beatings that the police here in New York City have given him.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. Michael Smith and Dahlia Hashad on Law and Disorder. Our next guest is attorney Michael Deutsch. Michael Deutsch used to be the litigation director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's now a partner at the famous Chicago law firm, the People's Law Office. This firm goes all the way back to the 60s. It was the firm that represented Fred Hampton's family, the head of the Black Panther Party, who was assassinated in bed by the Chicago police. And Michael Deutsch is now, along with Bob Bloom and Ben Elson, taking the case of a Palestinian businessman in Chicago, went to Israel, was arrested, imprisoned, tortured. A confession was wrung from this man. When he came back to Chicago to resume business, he was charged in Chicago, and the confession that was wrung by torture is now being used against him. Michael Deutsch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Tell us about this case.
Okay, Mohammed Salah is a Palestinian American who in January of 1993 came to the West Bank and Gaza in response to a human rights crisis that had occurred in December of 92 when 400 Palestinians were deported from their homes in the occupied territories to Lebanon, and another 1,600 were detained. And, of course, this was condemned by the United Nations and by even the United States at that time. And he was asked to bring money to the families of those people who were either detained or who were deported. And he did it as a humanitarian gesture, and he was meeting with families and others to give them some money. And he was arrested by the Israelis at a checkpoint, beaten up, and then put in the hands of the Israeli GSS, which is their Shin Bet interrogators. And for the next 80 days, he was subjected to just the worst type of torture. He was deprived of sleep. He was put in a refrigerator cell. He was put in a small chair, which is notoriously used by the Israeli interrogation. Threatened, his life was threatened. He was beaten. And he was forced to sign initially three statements in Hebrew. He doesn't read Hebrew or understand it. And he was forced to sign these three statements claiming that he was there to give money to Hamas military. And then, when they were still not satisfied with the information that he gave, they said, oh, well, your interrogation is over, and they put him in a cell which people who claim to be part of the resistance movement in Palestine, but in reality they were working with the Israelis. They were called birds. They even have a name for them in Israel. And these people proceeded to beat him and torture him, make him sit on a bowl that has a point on it, and threatened his life, and got him to write a statement which they provided him with the information, and forced him to give more information that they provided. And then ultimately, he was then put back in interrogation. Now we're going into the 90th day of his interrogation, and forced to give more information based on this handwritten statement. As a result of this, he was told that he could have a hearing to suppress the statement, but of course the hearing was in front of a military tribunal where he didn't have right to any of the memos that were written or any evidence that was used against him. And his lawyer told him, look, there's no way you're going to be able to challenge this. You might as well agree to plead guilty. And he pled guilty to being part of a terrorist organization, essentially. And was given a 5-year sentence.
In Israel?
In Israel.
And wait, what's happening? He's an American citizen.
He's an American citizen.
He disappears. Maybe he's in contact with his family while he's traveling, and all of a sudden he's at a checkpoint and he disappears off the face of this earth and he's thrown into prison.
For six days he's held in total incommunicado.
And his family does
what? His family's word is given to his family. They contact the U.S. consul, the Secretary of State, and then the U.S. consul in Jerusalem. And ultimately, after stalling and hiding him, they finally let somebody in after 7 days of him being, you know, just hidden, basically, from anyone. And then they don't let the consul in again for another 2 weeks. And meantime, they're going through this very rigorous torture interrogation that they're known to do. And, of course, at that time in Israel, the use of what they call moderate physical and psychological force was sanctioned by the government, and it was in documents that say they could use this isolation, sensory deprivation, this small chair where you sit on in a very difficult, painful position that they keep you for long periods of time, hooded with a smelly, rancid hood, kept in a refrigerator cell 3 feet by 2 feet where you can't lie down or even sit down.
Yeah, they blow air conditioning on you.
Yeah. I mean, it's all been documented. Human Rights Watch has done reports on it, et cetera.
I mean, they have torture down to a science.
Yeah, I mean, they're the best, and they're the most scientific as the way they can
break
the
United States
will.
is taking measures to catch up.
Listeners who's just joined us at Law and Disorder, I'm Michael Smith. I'm with Dalia Hashad. We're talking with Michael Deutsch of the People's Law Office in Chicago about his client, Mohamed Salah, who was tortured into a confession in Israel and is now on trial in Chicago, and they're trying to use that confession against him there in Chicago. Michael, did he wind up serving time in Israel and then was sent back to Chicago been charged again?
He served 5 years in Israel. He came home in 1997. At that particular time, there was some, you know, effort and lobbying to charge him, and the Clinton administration said, we don't have sufficient evidence against him. We're not going to charge him. He went back. He's living with his wife and family. He has 5 children. Trying to resume his life, although he was designated as a special terrorist by the Treasury Department, which meant he couldn't make money without a license or spend money without a license, but he was still trying to live his life. And then In 2004, the week before the Republican convention in Republican presidential convention, Attorney General Ashcroft has a big press conference where he's saying he's indicting Mohammed Salah and another man by the name of Oshkar, Dr. Oshkar, for being part of a criminal enterprise, to wit Hamas, and for providing material support to Hamas. Now, the thing that's all very interesting about this case, besides the fact that they're charging him based on tortured statements that they obtained by the Israelis obtained 12 years earlier, that at the time that he was in custody and being tortured, there was a big clamor in the United States, particularly in the Palestinian communities, about what was going on with him and why was he being held incommunicado, and there was a lot of publicity about it. And Yitzhak Rabin, who was then the prime minister, understand this, contacted Judith Miller and asked Judith Miller to come into the military interrogation center to view Mr. Salah's interrogation. And then she claims later on that she saw him being interrogated on closed-circuit TV. This is now 18 days after he's already been under.
What's her role? To make it kosher? Like
exactly.
The war
her role
Iraq?
Is to do two things. In the weeks before Mr. Salah was arrested, the Israeli government was putting pressure on the U.S. to stop monies coming from the Palestinian community to people in the occupied territories. They were claiming that the money was being used for military and terrorist activity.
Yeah.
And the U.S. at that time was saying, we have no evidence of that, and we're not going to stop people. They have the right to give money to their families and their relatives in the occupied territory.
Let me stop you for a second, Michael. You know, there was outright malnutrition there. There are, you know, hungry children.
Exactly.
There. They have
exactly.
No economy. They can't travel.
Exactly.
They're locked down.
And that, yeah, exactly. And Hamas and socially related groups were the ones that were providing for the care of those people.
That's what people don't understand. That they think in the United States people have been trained to associate Hamas with terrorist activities, and people do not understand that there is an enormous social welfare aspect of Hamas that provides basic services that the people just are unable to get under occupation.
Attorney Michael Deutsch, you're on Law and Disorder. Please continue with what happened to your client, Mohammed Salah.
So Israel was trying to pressure the U.S. to stop the money being sent over to the occupied territories. And when they arrested Salah, they said they had the perfect foil here to create this case that money was going for military reasons. And they had the perfect voice to do this, which was Judith Miller. So they got Judith Miller to write a series of articles at that time for the New York Times, quoting Israeli interrogators saying Salah has admitted that he was bringing money to fund the military and he wasn't being tortured and he was freely talking to them. And there was a series of articles written by her in the New York Times. At that time, she never mentioned in her articles that she later on claimed that she actually viewed his interrogation on closed-circuit television. What she was saying then was she was being provided this information by Israeli sources. So, therefore, that she was creating this publicity and public image that, in fact, money was being sent to fund military activity, and that, too, Salah was willingly providing that information. She was acting as an agent for the Israeli government and essentially assisting them in their campaign to force the U.S. to do something about monies being sent to the occupied territory.
Yeah, not surprising. One of our listeners actually contacted me and told me about his experience with Judy Miller at the Times. He used to work for the Times before 9/11, and he said Judy Miller would look for anything associated with Muslims and try to turn it into a terrorist event.
She's had a campaign on that since the early 90s. And she actually wrote a book called God Has 99 Names,
yep,
which was a treatise on her claim that all Muslims are evil and all they're into is terrorism and all this money is going to support them. She didn't mention that she had this special access for 3 years. And then when her book came out, she finally said, oh, I observed the interrogation on closed-circuit television, and he was cooperative and he wasn't being tortured. Of course, she saw less than 1 hour, if she did at all, of about hundreds of hours of interrogation, 18 days after he had been under their isolation and interrogation. So then it doesn't even end there. When the Clinton administration refused to indict Salah when he first came back here, and by the way, when he arrived in the airport from Israel, when he was released from prison, there was an FBI informant there to greet him, and that informant basically followed him for the next 7 years, writing 2 to 3 reports each month on him. We have like 500 reports about his involvement with Mohamed Salah. And the only allegation that they can make against Mohamed Salah since he got out of prison in Israel was that this informant claimed Salah sent him to the occupied territories to give money to the mother of a prisoner who was in prison with him in Israel.
Yeah.
And they claimed that he told this guy who doesn't live in the West Bank or the occupied territories to scout some targets for potential attacks.
Listeners, we are talking with Michael Deutsch of the People's Law Office. He's representing Mohamed Salah, a businessman in Chicago who's been charged by Ashcroft with providing material support for terrorism. This is a frame-up based on a tortured-induced statement by the Israelis. What status is the case now,
and what
can we do to help?
What the status of the case now is, we are preparing for a motion to suppress his statements. And this is going to be a unique situation because for the first time in a U.S. courtroom, Israeli interrogators from the GSS, Shin Bet, are going to have to come to a U.S. court and be cross-examined about their practices and policies.
That's great.
Good for you, Michael. Good for you.
Yeah. And also, we have, you know, evidence from the consular staff in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv about their inability to do anything about people who have been detained and tortured.
How hard does the consular staff try? Because I lived in the West Bank for a period. And let me tell you, when I met with the consular staff, I was not impressed.
It's true. They're very limited, and a lot of them acquiesce. But in fact, in Salah's case, they were outraged about the fact that they weren't given access, that he wasn't given a right to have an attorney for almost a month. There are cables from Warren Christopher protesting the treatment of Salah to the foreign minister of Israel. And there are several of these consulars who were furious about what was going on with Salah and saying this has been going on with other people. And we have now contacted a whole group of Palestinian Americans who had been detained and were similarly tortured by the GSS, who are willing to come forward and testify in his behalf. We're now fighting with the U.S. government to get all these memos and policy statements from the Israelis. The Israelis are resisting giving up a lot of documents, and this is a big fight to see how much evidence we're going to be able to get out of the Israelis, their policy statements, which show their methods and their uses in this particular case and generally are things we're after. So it's going to be a very interesting hearing in the first instance to suppress his statements, to show that he was tortured, how they do it, because they're very sophisticated. It's a lot of psychological game playing. It's a lot of isolation but you know, they don't tear people's fingernails out. They don't do it that way. They break your will and break your spirit and then force you to provide you with information and then force you to give it back to them. And basically what they were doing here was creating a political evidence that people from the U.S., Palestinians from the U.S., were funding Hamas, which was their political agenda even before they arrested Mohamed Salah. He's like a ploy in this game that the Israelis were trying to get the U.S. to stop the funding of help for Palestinians in the occupied territory.
You know, if you go on our website, lawanddisorder.org, you can flip to back shows. And one of the past shows that we did concerned another person, another American citizen, with a similar story. That's the case of Ahmed Abu Ali, who lived in Virginia, grew up in Virginia, U.S. citizen, went to study abroad in Saudi Arabia. And it's a case of reverse rendition where the U.S. asked the Saudi authorities to pick him up while he was a student there. He disappeared into Saudi custody, was tortured. While he was being tortured, he confessed to having a plot to free all the Guantanamo detainees himself and to assassinating President Bush on the sidewalk using three snipers. Now, they found there is no evidence that he actually came up with these plots, that he had done anything in furtherance of these thoughts, just that these were obtained in the course of torturous interrogation. And now back in the United States, he's being tried criminally for these crimes, supposedly these accusations.
And the judge just issued an opinion denying his motion to suppress. And one of the things that the government did in his case, which they may try to do in our case, they forced the defense lawyers to go to Saudi Arabia and take a deposition of the interrogators rather than force those interrogators to come to the U.S. courts to be cross-examined in open court. And, of course, that makes it a very much more difficult situation. And they play a deposition rather than have the person testify live in open court.
Well, can they force Saudi interrogators to come?
Yes, they can. There is a rule under the federal criminal rules of procedure which allow, in extraordinary cases, for deposition testimony in lieu of live testimony. And this is what the government's doing now to avoid having these foreign agents be brought to the U.S. court to have to be confronted in an open courtroom.
Michael Deutsch, before we say thank you and let you go, what can our listeners do? They've got their pencils in hand to help you and your client, Mohamed Salah.
Another interesting little thing is that the U.S. attorney in this case is Patrick Fitzgerald, the one that's being lauded as such a great, humanitarian and a great non-ideologue. So I would suggest that people write to Patrick Fitzgerald, United States Attorney's Office, Chicago, Illinois, 219 South Dearborn, and demand that the U.S. government not launder tortured statements from the Israelis and not use evidence that is obtained by torture in a U.S. courtroom. And I think that would be the most significant thing they could do at this juncture. As the case moves closer to the hearing, hopefully we'll be able to give you updates and more information on what they can do to help. Obviously, those listeners who happen to be in Chicago should come to court and show their support for Mohamed Salah.
Michael, what's the connection between this case and the Abu Ali case?
Well, the connection is the U.S. government using tortured statements by foreign agents. It's the same modus, They get somebody, they torture them, they get a statement, and now they're going to use it in a U.S. courtroom. And they're going to say, basically, well, we didn't torture them, and we're taking the word of these foreign agents that the person wasn't tortured. And you can't get the documents. You can't confront the witnesses because they're, thousands of miles away. And it's just part of a modus operandi of the U.S. government not only doing their own torture but using torture of foreign governments.
In Abu Ali case, at least, there are some scars on his back from the torture. What I worry about is the Israelis are torture experts, and they have long ago learned how to torture people without leaving actual marks, physical marks on their bodies. He doesn't have any physical marks.
No, doesn't have any physical marks because they didn't. What they basically did was break his spirit by isolation and
everything that they're doing. These stress positions—that is physical torture, causing great physical pain.
Yes, absolutely, it is under international law and coercion under U.S. law.
We'll get you back on the program, Michael Deutsch of the People's Law Office. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Seems I've got to have a change of scene, 'cause every night I have the strangest dream. Prison by the way it could be, left here on my own, or so it seems. I've got to leave before I start to scream. Someone's
locked the door and took the key. You're feeling all right. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, you're feeling all right. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, boy, you sure took me for one big ride. And even now I sit and wonder why. But when I think of you, I start to cry. Just can't waste my time, I must keep dry. Gotta stop believing in all your lies. Cause there's too much to do before I die. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, you're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself.
While protesting the detention conditions at Guantanamo Bay in Abu Ghraib, five young men, students at Hunter College, were wearing hoods and orange jumpsuits. They were yelling things like, "They're raping me, they're torturing me, please do something, don't just go to class," to their fellow classmates, and they were arrested for demonstrating without a permit. With us, we have one of those five young men, Joey Steele. He's the New York City Youth Coordinator for the World Can't Wait. He's sitting with us in the studio in an orange jumpsuit, Guantanamo style. And if you log on to our website, lawanddisorder.org, you can see it for yourself. Joey, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So, Joey, what happened at that initial protest?
2 days before that, two other students were arrested for doing the same thing. And a week before that, I was arrested for going into the lunchroom and doing the same thing and dragged away. And we came back over and over again to say that, look, we're not going away. The torture is not going away. This is not ending. And look at what we've all learned to accept in this country, this new normalcy. Except not only torture, openly justified. And that's
Well,
that's,
where'd you come up with the idea in the first place?
A number of people, including Sansara Taylor, one of the initiators of World Can't Wait, came up with this idea and thought it would be very imposing on some of the students and actually bring them forward. It's not to say that, oh, you know, you're looking away, but hey, you know, you don't want to look at this anymore. It was actually a reflection of some things in the 60s when people used to, some monks used to set themselves on fire in Vietnam. And, you know, looking back at those, and there was one person who was in college who looked back at that experience, and they were in a lunchroom one time. Someone came in and said, "Someone's outside setting themselves on fire." Now, a whole lunchroom poured out, and there's this body there on fire, and someone went around passing out marshmallows on sticks and saying, "Why don't you roast marshmallows on it?" And everyone just sort of like, you know, and some people would actually contemplate this. And in that time in particular, it happened to be a dummy. It didn't happen to actually be a real person. But that person has become a very active person ever since that moment.
Joey, now let's go back a step. This happened at Hunter University?
Hunter
undergraduate.
College. It was Hunter College. There's grad students and there's non-grad students. It's a CUNY college.
And you'd planned this with them beforehand?
Not with the school. I'm actually not a student at Hunter.
Oh, so you're the outside organizer and facilitator.
There was students from Hunter there with us and other CUNY students there with us. But, we went in there because we think that, first of all, Hunter College is a place where there's been radical activism and radical professors for a long time. And it was a really important school in the 60s and 70s. And we thought, oh, this wouldn't be a problem to go there and talk to students and engage them about what's going on in the world. The dean disagreed.
University police had arrested you on site?
What? I think they're technically public safety officials, but they're the ones who arrested
us. And they
us.
Took you off site?
They two of us were initially charged with, including felonies. They were initially charged with rioting. They had to drop those because obviously they couldn't pull that off. But
Are you still facing misdemeanor charges?
Yeah, including the dean had made a statement to, I guess, the prosecutor's office. And that's the reason that my lawyer actually thinks it's going to be going to trial, very likely.
So what do you face as a penalty?
I think that the misdemeanors have up to a year in jail. If you look back again at the 60s and you saw these students in Greensboro, North Carolina, sit at the counters of white-only diners, and likely what was going through their head is they're going to be lynched. They weren't going to go to jails. And I think that when we look at our futures and say we might be going to jails, obviously police have identified me as an outside agitator or whatever, and we say it's the worst to think about what world we're going to be living in under this Bush regime.
Joey, you must have some kind of positive support from Hunter University, Hunter College.
None. I mean, some professors have said that this is actually a good thing that they're doing this, but the dean of the school, I can't remember, Michael Escott, I can't remember his name, actually is one of the names of the people who've made a statement.
Oh, and what did that statement say?
The prosecutor hasn't disclosed it, but the statement basically says that it was an illegal act, trespassing, they didn't have permission, they had no right to be there, and they're going forward with this towards
trial.
Well,
are the charges against the students of Hunter as serious as the charges against you?
They haven't gone to court yet, and I don't know all of the charges that they have, but I don't think they're charged with trespassing.
And how does this, is this part of the World Can't Wait? Officially, you're acting as part of the coalition?
Yeah, we were all acting in support of the World Can't Wait, drive out the Bush regime effort.
What does the World Can't Wait stand for? What are some of your larger goals in doing this?
Our main goal is to drive out this Bush regime, saying that we're not going to unite with anyone who's going to agree with fascists. We have no reason to unite with those people. This regime needs to step down. Bush should step down, take his whole program with him. And until we do that, we're going to keep seeing these things, this new normalcy, this atmosphere of silencing dissent, all these atrocious actions, the banning of abortion, banning gay marriage. All these things are rapidly coming about in this country, and we're going to keep seeing it until this regime is repudiated.
And what kind of youth support do you have as a coalition?
Well, actually, November 2nd was a big day across the country. There's 185 actions all over the country, and the main people who came out were high school students. There's about 50 high schools we know that walked out, and these people walked out from their schools this
Wednesday.
Did
they have the support of the school administrations in walking out, or was it a voluntary act of?
Some administrators actually were supportive, but it was few and far between. The vast majority of them either threatened their students with lockdowns, locked them down.
Were actual lockdowns?
There were actually students who were locked down.
In public schools?
I'm not sure if they were in public or private. I'm not sure exactly, but I know there were students locked down. There was a woman who was suspended in Los Angeles. There was a student who was suspended and held in school in New York City. That was, I know, one of which is a private school. And there were a principal at one school in New York who stood at the door and called every single parent of a student who tried to leave. And this is a very progressive school. Students had to get out the fire doors, and they ran out any door they could to actually come to this protest. Students came out at great risk.
That's congratulations on your success over bringing so many out.
A thousand high school students came out at least.
Do you have plans for future actions?
Right now we are having a youth meeting, and we're going to continue to have them on Saturdays.
Where can people find out about that?
Well, you can go. You can do two things. You can check out the website worldcantwait.org, and we'll have information posted on there. You can also email us at nycyouth@worldcantwait.org.
It's clear that you want Bush to step down. What do you want to see besides that? What are some of your larger goals and your hopes?
Well, there's a lot of people in this movement to drive out the Bush regime who have, further-reaching visions of where they want to see the world and how to change things. There's obviously Democrats involved who want to see a Democrat ultimately replace the Bush regime. And then there's Republicans involved who want to see a Republican actually step forward and not all these other things. There are anarchists involved. I'm sure there's libertarians in other cities. I don't know who they are. But on November 2nd, like I said, there was 3,000 people in Union Square, thousands of students. And we had a permitted rally, a permitted march. And on that march route, a number of students were arrested. And I was singled out. Police massively came into the march.
Because we were wearing your bright orange jumpsuit. Yeah.
I wasn't actually wearing it then, but I've been arrested.
Do they know you as a leader?
I've been arrested 4 times now in the city, mainly for doing this. Abu Ghraib, this Guantanamo outfit. And they've obviously realized that these are the leaders. We're going to single them out, and we're going to drag them away. And they did. They physically dragged me away.
They just came and snatched you. Mm-hmm.
They also took a woman named Juanita Young, whose son was killed by the police.
Yeah. They know her well, too. Were there legal observers around?
The legal observers weren't right there. A number of people came over and took pictures of it, and they were beating me. They threw me against the car. They beat me in the back of the car, and they threatened me with worse beatings.
Were they using nightsticks or their
They were just mostly throwing me against things and throwing me on the ground and scraping me as we went along.
Do you, in addition to your legal defense, are you looking for support to publicize what's happened to you?
I think that there's one main way people can support what's going on, and that's actually by driving out this Bush regime. And it's going to happen more and more and more until we actually change the atmosphere in this country and very, very rapidly change it. We don't have months and months and months and a year and 3 years. You can tell the people in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, they have to wait 3 more years. They can't do it. We have to go to everybody in this country and say, if you want to support these people who are actually stepping forward, step forward yourself. Put things on the line. Sit at those counter tables. Put this outfit on. Go into these schools and risk whatever you have to risk, because, frankly, it's not going to be as much as you're risking not doing something to drive out this Bush regime. That's what the main way people can help. I mean, people can obviously send. We need lots of money for legal defense. We need lots of money for the worldcan'twait.org. And, you know, there's always monetary support, and that's very, very valuable and important. The main way people can help is actually by taking this up and doing everything in their powers and more to drive out this Bush regime, because the world can't wait. These torture victims can't wait. The students who are being arrested can't wait. The future can't wait any longer.
Do you have a total count of all the students who were arrested around the country the other day?
I don't have a total count of that. I know that there's a lot of students who were repressed in their schools. I mean, I don't even have a count in the city of the students who couldn't get out of schools. I know there was a lot more than we think there was.
And then do you continue to meet with students on a regular basis to plan what future activities you might engage in?
We're always meeting with students. Teachers who are supportive, professors who are supportive should bring us into their classrooms. Their teach-ins, let us come in and take over your classes the way they did a long time ago, and they need to start doing again. And actually, you know, they can bring us into these schools, and we have meetings all the time. Most of us quit all of our jobs to do this.
How long have you been doing this, Joey?
The World Can't Wait has been around for about 4 months or so. But I quit my job. I was a teacher, actually. I taught a seventh grade after school program in Cleveland and quit my jobs to come to New York City and be part of actually making this happen around the country. And a number of other people have all over the place.
That's very exciting. You're certainly a courageous young man and an example to many.
Thanks. Just one thing. I think that there's a lot of people in the country who think people are apathetic. I come from Ohio. People think I'm in New York City, and people think people in Ohio are just the most backwards people in the world. How could they let this happen, they say. People aren't apathetic. They just don't really know how to do this. Mm-hmm. They cry themselves to sleep. Mm-hmm. They hate where things are going, but they don't know that there's anything they can do after John Kerry turned their back on them, and they felt so left behind by all these people. And I think it's really important to see that Bush is not slowing down. He's not on the run. People think, you know, Harry Reid is going to come and sweep them away to a better future. It's not going to happen. We actually have to make a movement in this country that actually speaks to people's anger and hatred for this Bush regime and is commensurate with repudiating this whole agenda. And the only way to do that is by us doing it and not waiting for any saviors from the Democrats or any saviors from anybody else, but actually making it happen.
Joey, thank you so much. We hope to follow your case and hope that it turns out all right.
Thank you very much. Check out worldcan'twait.org for any updates.
We will. Thank you.
We'll put updates on lawanddisorder.org.
Thanks.
We are the
This book, which is about to come out, called A Farewell to Justice, Joan Mellon's latest book, is a real bombshell. The subtitle of the book is The Case That Should Have Changed History. It's a book about who killed John F. Kennedy.
Joan is the author of 17 books, ranging from film criticism, fiction, and Latin American studies to true crime, sports, and biography. Joan is a frequent contributor to the Baltimore Sun and has written as well for the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Los Angeles Times, and other publications too numerous to mention here.
The party line, I suppose you'd call it, the Warren Commission's report, of course, came out and said that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy. That was later changed when the House Assassination Investigation Committee said there was more than one assassin of Kennedy, so therefore there was a conspiracy involved. But nobody's ever really got down to the bottom of it. Hello, Joan Mellon. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Dahlia.
Joan Mellon, I understand that you've interviewed over 1,000 people. You have access to new documentary archives that have recently come out, and you've cracked the case, and that's what we want to talk about. Tell us, who do you think killed John F. Kennedy and why?
I began with Jim Garrison's investigation. And
tell us, who is Jim Garrison?
Jim Garrison, in the year 1963, was the district attorney in Orleans Parish. All those names are familiar now because of Hurricane Katrina. But Garrison was the district attorney, and at the time of the assassination, November of 1963, Garrison discovered that a resident of New Orleans named David Ferry was very close to Lee Harvey Oswald, who was the accused assassin, and in fact who had not even been shot. This was on the Friday and Saturday, the Friday of the assassination and the Saturday that followed. Garrison interviewed David Ferry, and then, because he had no intention of doing an investigation, he turned Ferry over to the FBI and the Secret Service. The FBI told the Secret Service to get lost, took over the case, and Ferry was released. And Garrison didn't do anything about it until a few years later. This is after the Warren Commission met. Garrison was friendly with Hale Boggs, who was on the Warren Commission, and Garrison was visiting Boggs in Washington, D.C., and Boggs confided something that had gone on in the secret sessions of the Warren Commission, which do not appear in the Warren report, and that is that Oswald was working for the FBI in the New Orleans field office. And when Garrison heard that, he began to do his investigation.
Wow, I didn't know that.
No, nobody did, because Garrison protected Hale Boggs' cover throughout Garrison's life. And Garrison always said that it was Russell Long who turned him on to investigating the assassination. But I discovered that that wasn't true at all. I found out, first of all, that Russell Long found that Garrison was already involved in his investigation when they took the famous plane trip to New York City, which Garrison often cited. And when Russell Long got off the plane, he said to his daughter, Garrison chewed his ear off about the assassination. So it was Garrison's second wife, actually, who told me that it was Hale Boggs who had really inspired him. And when the Warren report came out and it was clear that it was not an investigation at all, Garrison began again. And what Garrison discovered immediately was that Lee Harvey Oswald was working, Garrison discovered, for two government agencies. One was the FBI. That was the easy one to prove. The other was the CIA. And in my own investigation, based on the documents that were released to the National Archives under the JFK Act in 1992, what I discovered was that Oswald was also working for U.S. Customs, which was not surprising, since many CIA agents were exchanged and worked also for U.S. Customs, particularly in Key West and Miami, but obviously Oswald was another of those. Well, so Garrison had decided almost from the beginning that he realized that there was something wrong and that Oswald clearly was a low-level CIA agent.
So Oswald maintained all along that he was just the patsy. You agree with that, don't you?
Absolutely. And
well, if he was the patsy, who made him the patsy? Who did it? What did your investigation?
That's a very good question, Michael, because Oswald, in fact, that's when Oswald was arrested. He used that term patsy. And when I began to reuse it and think about it, I realized only an intelligence agent would even know that word. I'm a patsy. But what I discovered, and I think it's one of my best discoveries, came from a witness who lied to Garrison's grand jury, and his name was Thomas Edward Beckham. He was another New Orleans character, much like Oswald. Oswald had been born in New Orleans. And Thomas Edward Beckham was associated with also the CIA, so many people in New Orleans, which was a port, which was heavily CIA covered, that this Thomas Edward Beckham was sent to Virginia and was trained to be the fall guy, the patsy, should Oswald not have cooperated. And although Thomas Edward Beckham spoke to investigators from the House Select Committee, to which Michael just referred, he really waited, and he told only me, which I was very proud of, that in fact he was trained and to be the patsy should Oswald not work out. He was trained to be an agent. As it turned out, Beckham was not needed, and Oswald was indeed the person who was blamed for the assassination. But the very fact that the CIA trained Beckham shows us that it was the CIA, too, which set Oswald up to take the fall for the assassination.
I just want to remind our listeners we're speaking with Joan Mellon, author of the about-to-be-published bombshell of a book, A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. Joan, can you tell us then who did you zero in on terms of the CIA with the responsibility for killing Kennedy, and why would they have done that?
Well, I have a long chapter in A Farewell to Justice in which I discuss the motives of the CIA. And when you look at the conflict that John F. Kennedy had with the CIA and the fact that he was trying really to do what finally George Bush has done today, and that is eviscerate the CIA and take away its powers. The CIA at that time was extremely militant. What they wanted was a land war in Cuba. If they couldn't get a war in Cuba, they were going to get the war in Vietnam. And Kennedy was bitterly against this idea. He was against the deficit that would come from the ground war in Vietnam. It wasn't that Kennedy was a radical in any way. Kennedy was not, he was certainly an anti-communist, but he believed that if he couldn't win the Vietnam War with special forces, Green Berets, and the local military, then he preferred just to leave it alone. He did not want to see American lives lost in Vietnam, or in Cuba for that matter. And he went to war with the CIA. He began, memos were written by Kennedy's people, changing the powers of the CIA, cutting their budget, changing the powers of the Director of Central Intelligence. And the CIA fought back, and they fought back hard. Kennedy even, and I discovered this is really written for the first time in my book, where he sent Richard Goodwin down to No Name Key to talk to some of the soldiers of fortune down there and to try to enlist them to take over Radio Swan, which was the CIA radio station that was monitoring Cuba. So Kennedy did everything he could to really eviscerate the clandestine services. And it was the clandestine service under Richard Helms which I think really planned this crime. We can see the hand of their propaganda expert, David Attlee Phillips, but we can also see, and I should say, it was not the clandestine service alone, because we see Lawrence Houston, who was the chief counsel for the CIA, very much aware of everything that was happening as the CIA implemented its plan to cover up the assassination, and then to commit the assassination itself. One of the things that became clear from the evidence in Louisiana was that the cover-up began before the shooting in Dealey Plaza. And that, of course, demonstrates that the same people who did the cover-up also committed the crime. That the CIA covered up the assassination is easily provable. That the CIA planned it, of course, we don't have a document that says that. But all the evidence from Louisiana shows that the same people did both things, and that was the CIA.
Well, it truly is a Farewell to Justice, the case that should have changed history. Joan Mellon, the author, let me ask you one final question. What is the role here of Robert Kennedy, the Kennedy family? Why haven't they spoken out about this?
Well, Michael, that's really the right question. I found Robert Kennedy did everything he could to sabotage Jim Garrison's investigation, and I just couldn't understand it. Garrison could not understand it. Garrison said, listen, if it were my brother, I'd want to know what happened to him. And my last interview was in Miami in June, and I went down and I met one of the Cubans whose name was Angelo Morgado at the time when these events were going on in 1963. He later changed his name to Kennedy when he became an American citizen. But Angelo Morgado, under the he really was working for Robert Kennedy, was in New Orleans during 1963, and he began to put Oswald under surveillance, and he reported back to Robert Kennedy. So Robert Kennedy was aware of the man who would later be accused of killing his brother months before the assassination itself. And what happened there was that Angelo and others discovered that indeed, Lee Harvey Oswald was working for the FBI in New Orleans. And Robert Kennedy listened to that, and he said, well, if he's under the control of the FBI, then we don't have to worry. He's no threat. And they made this enormous mistake of not taking the surveillance of Oswald further and seeing for whom Oswald was working and unraveling the plot to kill John F. Kennedy before it happened. And Robert Kennedy was overwhelmed by this, and one, he certainly didn't want that known. And what he also didn't want known was that the Cubans who were working for him were also devising plots to murder Fidel Castro. And these were plots independent of the plots that the CIA had that have already come out under Operation Mongoose. But Robert Kennedy with General Edward Lansdale and his own team of Cubans were also plotting to kill Fidel Castro. None of this Robert Kennedy wanted to come out. He was willing to destroy Jim Garrison in order for it to be kept secret.
Joan, what do you hope will be the outcome of the release of this information in your book?
Well, I think that we have to look at our government, that we have to look at the consequences of our being lied to. I think 85% of people today in this country no longer believe that Oswald did this crime alone. But I think people have just sort of stood by and not said anything, not done anything. And I think the consequences of that, of people giving in, acquiescing in the silence, has been the government of George W. Bush that we find today with this unholy war that he's carrying on, and people feeling really powerless to do anything about it. Making these ideas known will have a very good effect.
Thanks. A great lesson for today. Joan Mellon, A Farewell to Justice is her new book, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination and the Case That Should Have Changed History, from Potomac Books, out this month. Thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Joan.
Thank you.
That was unbelievable.
Yeah, it certainly was. I remember the exact moment that Kennedy was killed. I was in college at the University of Wisconsin, and I was back at my apartment after classes ended that morning, and we heard it on the news. And the first thought I had was, I hope it's not a black person. And the second thought I had was, I hope it's not a socialist. Next day in the newspaper, there was a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald, who they said killed him. And Oswald was holding a pistol. I had a pistol on his side. He was holding a rifle up in front of him, and he was holding in his other hand a copy of a socialist newspaper called The Militant. And the interesting thing was there was a shadow falling down across from his nose, across his cheek in the front of his face, and there was also the sun behind him. So we thought about that for a while, and there was a lot of discussion about that, and it was concluded that either it was a total frame-up of Oswald or there were two suns in the sky that day. And that's what has kept me interested in this story. What is it? Since 1963, 37 and 5. It's been 42 years until Joan Mellon has finally written this Farewell to Justice book, which I think gets at the truth of it, that Oswald was set up to take the fall on this one, and that the elements in the CIA were the ones behind the cover-up, and before that, behind the assassination of Kennedy itself. And the motive, as Joan Mellon said, was Kennedy wanted to take back the presidency. He didn't want a ground war in Cuba, which they wanted. You remember, Kennedy stopped a full-scale war at the Bay of Pigs invasion, and the CIA was angry with him. And Kennedy didn't want a ground war in Vietnam. And in retrospect, he was right about that. It cost 53,000 American lives. It cost the war on poverty. It killed 3 million Vietnamese, destroyed Vietnam, and really set this country in the tailspin that we see it in today. Kennedy was absolutely right about that. He was no radical, but he was intelligent. And he took on the CIA and lost. And that's what her book is about.
It's a thick tome. How long did it take her to research all this?
8 years. She interviewed about 1,200 witnesses.
Oh, my.
And, you know, after this, the great movie, JFK, Oliver Stone's movie.
I never saw it.
Oh, it's a great movie. It was written by Zach Sklar. Stone made the movie. It was made based on Jim Garrison, the guy that brought the only prosecution in the case and lost, the New Orleans DA. It was based on Jim Garrison's autobiography. And then after the movie came out, under the Freedom of Information Act, you can't get this information today, but you could in the old days, before 9/11.
The old days,
that's so long ago. And all this information came out in the Kennedy assassination archives, and Joan Mellon got a hold of it. It was Oliver Stone who did the great public service of asking for this information. It all came out. She got a hold of it, and based on her research in these archives and based on the 1,200 people she interviewed afterwards, she was able to write A Farewell to Justice. It's a dynamite book. Joan Mellon's A Farewell to Justice. People should get it.
Freedom fighters, speak with your tongues. Sing. Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady.
Peace loving women, single or wed, give thanks.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Dear him and out. My mama told me, Papa said it too. Son, the world's divided and you know your cause is through. Do you hear me now? Do you hear me now? There's snowmen in the winter, blossoms in the spring. If they drop the bomb in the summertime, it won't mean a doggone thing. Do you hear me now? Do you hear me now? Freedom fighters, speak with your tongues, sing with the might of the wind in your lungs. Do you hear?